America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. Our last post featured John Marshall, a journalism professor at Northwestern University, discussing his book, Clash, and the relationship between presidents and the press. In the latter portion of his book, he focused on the changing nature of the media itself. Some say old media versus new media, but in fact it's all merging into one very confusing landscape of information, and oftentimes disinformation, much of it unvetted and designed to mislead. Two central points emerge. First, that the business of news is changing, and that's having an impact on content. And secondly, you must be a more literate consumer of news content. May I say that coming to America Trends is a great first step. Important information ahead here on America Trends.
With us on America Trends for part two of our conversation is John Marshall, an associate professor at the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University. And I've got to say that we had a great conversation just days ago on the book Clash, Presidents and the Press in Times of Crisis. But Professor Marshall, I couldn't leave it there, because you opened up in the latter part of your book somewhat of a can of worms for me, because it's about the state of the news media today in relation to the presidency. But then you walked us through the fact that we're not only talking about the presidency of the United States and the ability of the press to cover the president well, but really all forms of government, all levels of government. And you say that the declining economic health of the news business has sapped its ability to hold presidents accountable, and it's also really affected the ability for local governance to be monitored and checked.
Yeah, well, first of all, Larry, thank you for having me back again. It's an honor to be on your show a second time. And that's right, the changing economics of journalism has indeed sapped the ability of the press to cover presidents as effectively as they could, but just as much so, local governments, whether it's at the county or village or city level, and also state governments, and even covering businesses and corporations and large nonprofit institutions as well. There's just not the level of scrutiny as there once was because of those changing economics.
Now, there is a lot of information out there, clearly, and so someone listening to this might say, I have no dearth of information, but it may not be high quality. It may not have a gatekeeper or someone curating that content. And let's put it in perspective. Since 2005, about 2,200 local newspapers across the country have closed. Now, that's a remarkable number, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a very large number. We now have many communities across the country that have no regular newspaper or news website or news broadcast covering their communities. And when that happens, that allows government and any other powerful institution in the community to have nobody really watching over them, no sort of watchdog. And people can get information through social media, but most of the deeply reported gathering of facts is going to be coming from a news outlet, and through most of U.S. history, that's been newspapers who have had the kind of staffs and the kind of commitment to do that kind of deep reporting. So what you're often end up with now are rumors or third-hand information that hasn't been verified, and that can be very dangerous for the operation of a democracy when the public doesn't really know what's going on in their community and allows bad actors to gain power and be corrupt.
Yeah, over 65 million Americans are now living in counties with only one local newspaper or none at all. I mean, that is really stunning. But I've got to say that in the old days, and you and I are probably old enough to remember all of this, it was a printing press. I mean, to have a printing press, it was almost like you could just throw dollars and money into that thing because it was so profitable, as were licenses to local broadcast stations. So what happened to the traditional business model?
You're right, Larry. It was a highly profitable business. Newspapers wasn't unusual for them to have revenue 20% profit margins, and sometimes local TV stations around 30%, which is much higher than most businesses enjoyed. But several things happened really in the last two or so decades to change that. One was that a lot of these news companies got greedy, borrowed a lot of money so that they could try to buy other businesses, and went into debt. And then when they couldn't pay off those debts due to economic recessions and changing technology, they were in a financial crisis. And my hometown Chicago Tribune is an example of that. In the 90s, early 2000s, went on a shopping spree. They bought the Los Angeles Times. They bought a bunch of newspapers around the country and television stations, and they were trying to be much more of a media conglomerate. And as the finances of the news industry changed, they found themselves in big trouble in terms of debt and ended up having to shrink their workforce tremendously. And that story has played out in many places and with many, many news outlets around the country. We've also seen milder recession in the early 2000s and then the really bad recession at 2008, 2009, and then again in 2020 when COVID hit. That hurt the news industry dramatically because a lot of the big advertisers like automobile dealerships and department stores cut way back on their advertising, which was revenue that these news outlets depended on. And then you and I probably remember the days when if you wanted to find an apartment or look for a job or buy a used car, the place you went was the classified advertisements in your local newspapers. Online has obviously changed that, and I think very few people would look to the local newspaper now to get that kind of advertising and would instead turn to Craigslist or any of the many dozens of ways you can look for that kind of information online as well. And then, of course, with digital media, social media, the internet, more and more people are getting their news online and are not turning to traditional news outlets for that information. Some news outlets have been able to adjust and give themselves a very strong digital presence. New York Times would be one example of that, who've succeeded. And then there's a lot of new entrants into the news marketplace, places like Politico and Axios and the 19th and pretty much any kind of field that you're interested in, whether it's sports or food or fashion or business, you can find, you know, probably dozens of places online that are presenting information, but that in turn has fragmented the marketplace and made it hard for any news outlet to have enough of a critical mass to really be successful, and only a few of the larger media organizations are going strong still.
Why do you think that the strong nature of the brands that have been established in communities across the country haven't really converted a lot of those who now don't subscribe any longer to the print version, make them unwilling also to pay for the digital version of one of their local newspapers? Why has the print press not been able really to convert, the New York Times being an exception, the Washington Post, maybe the Wall Street Journal? But
right.
Why have many not been able to do that, do you think?
Well, there was this notion about 15, 20 years ago that if you just put things up for free online, you would attract enough viewers, enough visitors to your sites that the advertisers would follow, and that's how you would be able to convert your business to primarily being online. That didn't work very well because some advertisers did follow, but the amount that they were willing to pay for digital ads was only a fraction of what they were willing to pay for advertising in print because they saw that advertisements in print, there was more of a sort of stickiness to them. People actually looked at them more, and the advertisers would get more bang for their buck. Digital ads, people just glide right over them or click away from them, and it's very hard to get the same kind of bang for your buck from an advertiser's perspective, so they are in turn paying less for them. And then a great deal of the revenue from that is digital actually flows to Google and to Facebook and a few other of the online platforms. I think it's roughly 3/5 of the digital advertising dollars go directly to Google and Facebook and not to the news organizations that are doing the reporting and the editing of the news, but rather to the platforms that are carrying them, so that money isn't flowing through to the news producers. And that's had a very detrimental effect.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about the whole notion of aggregation. And for the news media business, the traditional ones, it's been aggravation. Let's go back to Matt Drudge and the Drudge Report, and then how the digital platforms are allowed to use this content and then resell it. They're also reselling a lot of other content as well that is not generated by the traditional sources. But how has the digital platform, like a Facebook, really been able to convince advertisers? Is it the pricing mechanism? Is it the repeated nature of people going back and back and back to Facebook? What is it that has made them able to convert this digital advertising into a model that seems to work when the newspapers, still doing print often, but also adding to it digital, still see their advertising revenue between 2008 and 2018 suffering a 68% drop?
Digital giants have such volume of, well, in the United States, hundreds of millions, and around the world, billions of people, that they can charge a very low rate for an advertisement per view, but still make a great deal of money from that. And if I post a story on Facebook that I've seen in my local newspaper or magazine I like, or for my local TV station, a clip, I can put it on my Facebook feed or my Instagram or my Twitter. There's no charge for me to do that, obviously.
Right.
And people can look at it, and they don't have to click through to the original source of the information to see it. If they did eventually click through, then the news producer, the people who created the content originally, might start to get some of that money from advertisers because they would see that people are visiting their sites. But as I look through my Twitter feed or my Facebook stream, I'm not necessarily clicking on it on everything. I'm just kind of skimming through it and liking or sharing stuff that I haven't even necessarily visited. And I don't think I'm the only one who does that. So it's sort of how those platforms work. And Facebook can still sell advertising against that, because as I'm flowing through, I still see the ads that are being posted on Facebook. And even if they're not charging the advertisers very much money for that one particular ad, there's millions of people like me doing it, so it does add up.
Facebook and Google, now they aggregate and then they distribute this news content that helps the publishers reach more consumers, but they also are the greatest competitors in the digital advertising market. And I was shocked to read how much these two companies alone account for about 77% of the digital ad revenue in local markets, thus squeezing local news publishers. So for somebody listening who doesn't understand why their formerly robust newspaper either is now published in print 3 or 4 times a week, or it is now down to a size of a former shopper that they used to get in the mail. I mean, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, Professor Marshall, it's unbelievable how little content in my daily newspaper there is.
Right, and I think that's playing out across the country. So if the local newspaper is not getting those advertising revenues from companies who are willing to advertise in the print edition, and they're getting very little from the stories that are being posted on Facebook or shared elsewhere, they are scrapping for money, which in turn means they can't afford to hire the reporters and the editors to do the actual reporting that would make for a more robust newspaper. Some of them have switched to having a system of paywalls, and really the Wall Street Journal was the company that was probably the pioneer with that, and they said, you know, we're confident enough that we are offering content that is worthwhile and special enough that people should be willing to pay for it. And they had a dedicated enough audience that they put up a paywall, and once you visited the Wall Street Journal, and I don't know the specific number of times, but a few times a month, you had to start actually paying for what you read. And a lot of other news companies said, no, we can't do that. We should just, you know, keep the content free and hope to sell enough ads. That didn't work. The Wall Street Journal's model was working much better. So now we see a lot more news organizations saying, okay, you can look at, say, 3 articles for free per month. But actually, after that, if you think our content is that worthwhile, start paying for it with some sort of subscription. And that seems to be gradually working for some companies. You know, the New York Times is doing that now as well, and any number of magazines and newspapers are trying that too.
Well, in my state of Connecticut, the Hartford Courant was one of those bought up by Tribune. Now they've all gone over to a venture capital group, I guess, and I don't know what that means, except that I was talking to a reporter there recently, and they used to have 300 reporters covering the state of Connecticut, the Hartford Courant. They're down now to 17. And of course, I remember the days when the state houses were being covered. Now, there are these niche services coming along in Connecticut. It's Connecticut News Junkie, and then there's an aggregator like Drudge City Capital Report that is amassing a lot of content from across the state of Connecticut. But what have we lost as you look at it as a professor of journalism? What is it like, even the kids who are coming through your classroom today, what is their hope in terms of the type of job that's going to be available to them if they want to get into this incredible field of reporting?
We have definitely lost a lot. I want to focus first on what we've gained, because I think it is a double-edged sword there. We have gained a lot more variety in the kinds of sites that are available to people. You can find a lot more specialized information in fields that you're interested in. I'll give myself as example, myself as a sports fan. When I was growing up in Phoenix, Arizona, if I wanted to watch baseball, I had to wait for the weekly game of the week on Saturday mornings. And if I wanted to watch other sports, I would watch the Wide World of Sports on Saturdays, which might have boxing or bowling or bull riding or all sorts of different stuff. But I had to wait for that sort of curated content and hope that the TV network would carry it. Now I or my children, my students, if they're interested in golf, there's the Golf Channel. There's any number of golf websites. If they're interested in baseball, there's, you know, many dozens of different places they can go. Same for any kind of sport. And that's true for any field of interest. Again, if you're interested in business, you know, many, many dozens of different places you can go to get specialized business news, depending on what kind of industry you're most interested in. You know, same with lifestyles and food and entertainment. So there are a lot of niche outlets out there, which are a lot of the places where my students are getting jobs. And the other benefit we've seen is I like to think about, oh, the glory days of news. When I was growing up, back in the day, everything was better. And in some ways it was. But in other words, you know, there was a lot less diversity in terms of who was presenting and covering the news. It was mostly a lot of people who looked like me, white men, middle age. And now a lot greater diversity of voices are having an opportunity to present information and perspectives that we never heard before or saw before in the news. And I think that's a great advantage. But the flip side of that, or the sorts of things that you've talked about, are that news outlets that on a day-to-day basis were covering local governments, state governments, and even the national governments have been stripped of reporters, which makes it harder for the places who are doing investigative reporting, because that really kind of takes a critical mass of reporters and enough finances to support it. It also makes it harder for people in a community to have a common conversation about what's going on in the news if we're all getting our information or possibly misinformation from dozens of different places. When we meet around the water cooler or in the park and start talking about what's going on, we've got widely varied sources of information that make it really hard to sometimes agree on anything.
And it seems as if communities where there really isn't a newspaper that has any strength left or any capacity left, and it seems as if, by the way, and you can correct me, that when they look for cuts, they always look at the content side because a lot of their other costs seem to be fixed. And I can only imagine running a newspaper and trying to distribute it to as many boxes as you can around. There's a lot of costs involved. We understand that. But having said that, local communities that don't have that critical investigative work going on, from what I've read, they end up with higher taxes, they end up with a disengaged public, and it seems as if a lot of people are distracted by what's happening on the national level and becoming much less involved, even going to the polls. In the city that I came from, it used to be a political hotbed. And now, I think for mayoral campaigns, they're lucky to get 25 to 30% of the people out. It's just a terrible thing that's happening to our democracy, let alone to the news media business.
Well, I think 25 or 30% is actually probably a pretty high rate for local elections, which is a sad thing. I think it's even lower in some communities around me. And I think you're right. There have been studies that show when there isn't a watchdog news organization covering a community, there does tend to be more corruption. There does tend to be higher taxes, and there does tend to be fewer people participating in the process. And there have been several cases of that. There was a famous one in Bell, California, outside of Los Angeles, that for years wasn't being covered by any local newspaper, and ends up the local town council was basically using the city government as their personal piggy bank, stealing money from taxpayers. So the LA Times finally put a reporter to cover the city, and they uncovered what was going on. And that kind of story is probably, you know, repeating itself around the country. And I think you're also right that we are distracted by national politics. They've been rather intense lately, especially during the Trump administration, but we're still seeing it during the Biden administration, the amount of partisanship that's there. And it's easier to cover one person, the president, for a news organization to do that than it is to cover the much more complicated and multitude of different governments that are around the country, and to have reporters in state houses and in city council chambers covering what's going on, much less also Congress, where you've got 435 representatives. It's much more challenging to cover. So the cable channels and a lot of the national news outlets, print outlets, will put a lot of their resources in covering the president, covering the White House. You're almost guaranteed a story a day, if not more than one story a day out of it, but shying away or not putting the resources into the smaller levels of government that can have just as much impact on people's lives.
When we look at what we're going to do about all of this, because a lot of people have been thinking about it, policymakers, you offered a suggestion or two in your book. So let's talk about what can be done to strengthen local journalism or journalism overall. There's a discussion of a tax deduction for personal subscriptions to eligible local news organizations that might incentivize more individuals to pay for local journalism. They're talking about tax offsets for eligible production expenses incurred by newsrooms. What do you think we could do to strengthen local journalism? I know there's this Local Journalism Sustainability Act. Help us to understand what's in that.
Yeah, the Local Journalism Sustainability Act was introduced by Representative Kirkpatrick of Arizona, Ann Kirkpatrick. And it has, it's one of those rare breeds in Washington. It actually has bipartisan support. It's got 70 co-sponsors at this point, Democrats and Republicans. It's been introduced in the House of Representatives, and it would do a few things. It would allow people who subscribed to a news outlet or made a donation to a nonprofit news outlet, and we haven't talked about the growing nonprofit sector, but if you make a donation to a journalism site or subscribe, you could get up to a $250 tax credit to do that. Advertisers who advertised in news outlets could also get a tax credit to reduce the cost for them and in turn give some more much-needed revenue to news gatherers. You know, the news outlets in turn can't just pocket the money. They actually have to hire reporters and editors and camera people and so forth in order to get a tax break themselves. But if they are actually hiring journalists and not doing the kind of cost-cutting that you talked about a few minutes ago, they could get a tax break as well. So it's using tax breaks both to incentivize consumers to go ahead and support news outlets and to incentivize news outlets to hire people and then also advertisers to advertise, and that would be a great help. Another possibility it would be to revise or repeal what's known as Section 230 of the Telecommunications Act that was passed in 1996. And that, generally speaking, gives tech platforms immunity for the content that is posted on them. So if a newspaper or TV station prints or broadcasts something that is wildly inaccurate and libelous, and they have not made any effort to verify their information and have acted maliciously, they can be sued for libel and pay a big cost for that. The tech platforms at this point don't pay any cost for that, for the information that they carry. And what we haven't discussed yet is how the algorithms of these tech platforms tend to benefit content that is the most controversial, the content that causes the most people to post, you know, little icons that they're angry about something or to comment angrily about things. That kind of heated content gets the bigger priority in terms of what is rewarded. And every once in a while, the tech platforms say, oh, we're going to reform that, and they'll make some changes, but then it tends to slip back to going back to the most controversial content, because that's how they make the most money. So what I suggest in my book is if the tech platforms do not reform themselves in that way, and do not do more to actually pay the news producers, for the content that they are carrying, because the news producers can be sued for libelous content at this point, the tech platforms can't. If they don't make those changes, then it's time for Congress to make some changes in Section 230 that gives that broad immunity to places like Facebook and Google.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. We did an entire podcast on Section 230. I think the audience might have fallen asleep because it's a little technical.
It's complicated.
It's important. But having said that, you know what I don't think people really understand, and here's the dirty little secret, folks, that the newspapers, the old get-your-hands-dirty newspapers, have been so important for so many reasons. One being that when you look at your local radio stations or even your local television stations, aside from an Associated Press kind of operation, that's where they're getting all of their leads and all of their activity. So it all spawns from something that now is starting to dry up. And that means that they're focused on things that, well, may not have a lot of consequence, because they'll, you know, find a car crash or something else. And they're important, but obviously you want to know contextually what's going on in your community. So either people are going nationally or they're going to stories that don't really affect what's going on with local governance. And I think that's where we're getting cheated. Now, let me ask you this. You talked about the nonprofit models. One of the ideas for a reform Is the tax code encouraging more newspapers to operate as nonprofits? Now, I know that we have some digital platforms today in my state of Connecticut and around the country that started as nonprofits. The only problem with that, and I worked for a nonprofit media company of public broadcasting for so many years, is that you're still looking for grants, you're still looking for those who will support your work. And if that grant, say, that you get from Knight Ridder Foundation or some of these other great organizations dries up, what happens to you and your ability to cover what now has become a vacuum that you have filled?
Well, that's a great question. And that's actually one of the encouraging things that's been happening the last few years is the growth of the nonprofit model of journalism. As you say, it's existed for a while with PBS and NPR. Associated Press is actually a nonprofit. The St. Petersburg Times, which became the Tampa Times, was owned by a nonprofit. And we're starting to see more of that, both some of the legacy newspaper companies. The Philadelphia Inquirer is now connected with a nonprofit, the Salt Lake Tribune. Ooh. And then recently in Chicago, where I am, the Chicago Sun-Times worked out a deal with the local NPR affiliate, WBEZ, and they've combined forces. So now the Sun-Times is operating, or I'm not sure if the paperwork's all done yet. If they're not already, they will soon be operating on a nonprofit basis. And that gives some real advantages. First of all, if you're a nonprofit, you're not paying taxes, so you don't have that expense anymore. And as you said, Larry, it allows people, individuals as well as foundations and other philanthropies, to make donations. In addition to legacy media outlets like the ones I just named, we have places like ProPublica, which is maybe now the premier investigative news operation in the country, which was founded roughly 15 or so years ago as a nonprofit. And has been working very well as that model. And then there's also smaller local news operations, like the ones, some of the ones you're seeing in your neck of the woods, primarily digital at this point. So they have lower costs as well. So if you're primarily digital, operate as nonprofits. There's, you know, one in San Diego, the Voice of San Diego, that's done actually some very good investigative reporting there. It's not a large newsroom, but they don't have the cost of printing press. They don't have the cost of having to pay delivery people and having delivery cars or vans deliver the newspaper. They're not having to pay for the paper itself. So there's much lower cost if you're a digital operation. If you're a nonprofit, you're not paying the taxes. So they're able to sustain themselves and do some excellent reporting. A lot of the news ecosystem depended on daily newspapers for their information, the TV stations, the radio stations. And there's been studies showing that a great majority of the content actually, even if it was appearing elsewhere, originated with newspapers. When I was a reporter down in Florida, I would drive to work in the morning and turn on the local radio station and listen to the local newscast, and I'd hear them say a story, and I'd be like, oh, that's a nicely, you know, sounding story. That was written really well, and an interesting subject. And I think second, I'd be like, wait, I wrote that story. That was my story.
Well, the only thing
saying
they did,
it almost verbatim, they're not giving credit to the local newspaper.
Well, luckily, they didn't make the mistake of saying continued on page 3.
Right.
And let you know where they took it from. Let me ask you, you do say in the book Clash that the government might want to look at Facebook and other platforms to send back more revenue to the reporting services that provide the content. Another way of looking at these large online platforms who are undercutting the business model for local news is a tax on them or a temporary exemption from antitrust laws that would give news publishers the ability to collect and negotiate with these large online platforms. Do you see those as realistic going forward?
I do. You have to recognize that Facebook and Google and Twitter and the rest have very powerful lobbying organizations in Washington. They donate a lot of money to a lot of politicians. But in the state of Maryland, introduced a tax on digital advertising revenue. Some countries in Europe have done something similar. A few other states around the country have been looking into that. Australia has a law requiring Facebook and Google and other digital platforms to pay for the news that's appearing on their platforms. So there are examples of that where it's happened in the United States and in other places around the country that we might be able to use to develop a more systematic approach on a national level, that if the large tech giants are not doing more of their share of actually paying for the news that they're making money off of, that there can be some laws put into place to counter that.
I know there are some fig leaves going on, and maybe they're better than that, but I know we have a local paper in Waterbury, Connecticut called The Observer, and this one-man operation does a great job. He just got a grant from Facebook. They are trying to incite more local journalism through various programs that they have. I just don't know how serious and sustained that is going to be. I think in the end, I've got to ask you this because you're the perfect person to ask. You teach at a college level, so you're teaching young people. They're the ones who are going to be the news consumers going forward. And when I read about them, I hear that what they look at is TikTok and Reddit and other forms of information that I don't really look at very much. But my question is, have we lost them? What is it that they tell you they're looking for, and where do they find it?
Very interested in what's going on in the world, and I'm not sure if it's any less so than our generation. But yeah, they're getting it in a lot of different ways. They're getting it in fragmented ways. So they might see a video on YouTube, they might see a TikTok video, they might see posts on Reddit or any number of other ways. So they're getting information, they're able to sort of specialize more in the information that they're getting. My students who are really interested in sports probably know way more about sports than I did at their age, even though I was very interested in sports at their age because they could just get it from so many more places than before. Students who are interested in, say, what's going on in the Middle East can probably get a lot more information now about what's going on in the Middle East from people who live in the Middle East and work there and analyze it directly than I could have when I was in college. So there is a lot more specialized ways to get information. What I think is challenging is sort of putting that all together and seeing how it maybe fits into a bigger picture when it's consumed in a fragmented way like that. And it also makes it easier for them to ignore things that they're not interested in or to miss things that they might serendipitously have found by, I started reading newspapers, first of all, to look at the comics. And then the sports section, and then I started looking at the news, and then I picked up some business along the way, the further I went. But as I would flip through the newspaper, I would see things that I wouldn't have thought I was interested in, but I'm like, I wonder what that's about. And they still get that in some degrees through, depending on who they're following on social media, they might pick it up that way. But I think by and large, it's harder for students, younger generation to kind of get information that is put together in the curated form that we had with a network news broadcast or a daily newspaper.
Well, there is a lot of uncurated material out there juxtaposed with the curated, and it really, to me, falls to the consumer to be aware of where the content is coming from and the intentionality of the presenter. I mean, here we are, you and I are speaking on an uncurated platform, that being podcasting. We didn't really talk about that. So there is a great deal of diversity, but it really does require somebody to be a critical thinker. And I remember in the old days, Professor, when there was something like Newspapers and Education, the NIE, trying to help people to discern their media literacy. So I don't know, it's going to be a challenge because there are so many different platforms, and some are really reputable, others less so. But we'll see where we go going forward. Do you have anything you want to say in conclusion?
Well, that is actually how I conclude my book, Clash, is a call for greater media literacy. I think it should be taught in the schools at the same level that we teach math and literature. And I think math and literature are very important. I'm not saying we shouldn't teach those. But I think media literacy is just as important because people consume media almost all day long. And it's greatly influencing what they know and the choices they make. And I think students as well as adults should learn how to recognize what's news and what is propaganda, look at how to verify information, understand how algorithms work on social media and how certain kinds of content are being promoted to them at the expense of other kinds of content, to understand how advertising tries to shape their viewpoints and tries to sell to them, to help learn how to find a variety of different perspectives on the news and to recognize what might be a fake video, what might be a fake photograph, what might be fake information in a news story, and just to be a lot smarter and savvier in terms of discerning what kind of content they are consuming as young people, and if we can persuade the older generation to take these courses as well, I think it would be beneficial to them. So I really think everybody from local school boards through the Department of Education should think about making a concerted effort at making news literacy part of our basic education.
That is a great summation to our two conversations. And of course, this is John Marshall from Northwestern University, the author of Clash. And let me just tell you, Jonathan Carl from ABC News, who himself has just written a really powerful book that lots of people have paid attention to. He said it's a must read for anybody interested in the vital role of a free press in a democratic society. A wonderful acknowledgement from Jonathan Carl for our guest, John Marshall. And again, thank you so much for your generosity and spirit and knowledge and time. I really appreciate it here on America Trends.
Larry, thank you for having me on. It's been a true pleasure to have this conversation.